Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join historian and author Manu S. Pillay for an illuminating talk on his latest book, Gods, Guns and Missionaries. Pillay explores the complex interplay of religion, colonial power and armed conflict in shaping the Indian subcontinent's past. Recorded live at the 2025 Festival, Pillay sheds light on the turbulent forces that have shaped modern India's history and identity.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Bradford Literature Festival, and welcome to the session. My name is Professor Saeed Khan, coming to you by way of Detroit and Wayne State University, where I teach Near East and Asian Studies, Global Studies, and I also direct the Center for the Study of Citizenship. As many of you know, I really live for this festival and look forward to it every year, and in part just because the crowds and the audiences are so vibrant and really so well-informed. And I know that you're going to enjoy this session as much as I've been anticipating. We are joined by Manu Pillay, who is the author of the critically acclaimed Ivory Throne, Chronicles of the House of Travancore, Rebel Sultans, the Deccan from Khilji to Shivaji, the Courtesan, the Mahatma, and the Italian Brahmin, Tales from Indian History, and False Allies, India's Maharajas in the Age of Ravi Varma. He's the winner in 2017 of the Sahitya Academy Yuva Puraskar, awarded by India's National Academy of Letters to writers under the age of 35. And he holds a PhD in history from King's College London. His most recent offering is Gods, Guns, and Missionaries, The Making of Modern Hindu Identity. Welcome, Manu.
Thank you, Saeed. Pleasure to be here, and thank you for showing up in such wonderful numbers. And I wasn't sure how many people I'd draw in Bradford. I was telling my Malayalam publisher that I'm quite convinced there'd be seven people in the audience, but it's very reassuring to see that it's multiples of seven.
I never pegged you for being such a pessimist.
No, not really. I had great events in the UK so far. But you know, you as a writer, you're always a bit concerned that, you know, there's always going to be that one event that depresses you and feels like, you know, none of this is worth it. But so far, this isn't that day, clearly.
You could have just said that you had that day already and everything looking forward is great. First of all, on a personal level, you and I were talking about this. I really enjoyed your book because it was accessible. As a fellow academic, I mean, I find books that are mired in jargon and dense language to incur narcolepsy. And this is a critique about my own writing I get from my family. but I really found your book to be just really compelling as a read. So thank you for that. And I was thinking about this from the standpoint that there's a tension in how we look at religion. And obviously, in your title, you're talking about Hindu national identity. So religion is never far away from the conversation, and sometimes obviously it's central. And it seems as though most religions as we understand them, or some would see religions, and particularly as their followers see religions, as being proactive, affirmative expressions, creating a system, a way of life, if you will. And then there's this idea that religions form historically as a response to, a reaction, a rejection, a rebuke to the status quo. So, for example, Judaism comes in as a rejoinder to paganism, Christianity as a rejoinder to Judaism, Islam to polytheism, and other monotheisms. Where does Hinduism fit into that paradigm?
Hinduism isn't one of the religions that fits this mold very easily. There are elements of it to Hinduism, but for most part, I think of it as a framework rather than something that's easily comparable to a religion of the book. Because what it does is, as the first chapter, the introductory chapter, attempts to explain, as Brahminical culture, Brahmins are essentially the priestly elite of Hindu society, as that spread across the Indian subcontinent, it encountered all kinds of religious formations. There were tribal cults, there were non-vegetarian deities who required sacrifices of flesh and blood and human beings. There were very vegetarian deities who consumed milk and honey. There were cults that believed in image worship. There were others who thought of God in a more abstract sense. And Hinduism, in some ways, is an amalgamation of many of these things. And what you find, therefore, is that it's not one fount, but many. It's not one river, but many streams flowing into something ultimately. And it creates a framework in which everything is allocated different slots. So the way Hindu society is reconciled to this diversity is by saying that we'll create a hierarchy. So there are higher gods who are vegetarian, and the gods who are non-vegetarian are considered lower in the scheme of things. But again, from one perch, for the people actually worshipping those gods, I don't think they'd see it that way. So it creates these slots in which the multiples are all acceptable. They're all placed in different brackets and different spaces in the framework. So Hinduism really is a framework rather than a religion recognizable in the typical Western sense, which is why for everything you say about Hinduism, the opposite can also be true. It's a cliche about India. Anything you say about India, the opposite is also true. And that's true of Hinduism. You have the monotheistic idea of God as this abstract entity beyond shape and form. But you also go travel through India and travel through our villages and you'll see physical forms of all kinds of gods. In my village in Kerala, we have a deity who's, the way you worship this particular god, he's a Shasta, which is a South Indian god, is by clapping 101 times and grinning like a freak in front of this deity. And that's how he is venerated. There's, in my family temple, my mother's family has two goddesses. And you find that one of the goddesses is a Vanadurga, goddess of the grove. She requires to be exposed to all the elements. So she can't have a roof ever. So even if you build a sanctum for her, it's four walls, but there's a hole in the roof. Because the rain, the wind, the leaves, they have to fall on her because she was originally a tribal goddess. But there's another goddess who requires a roof because that's her particular mythology, that's her particular story. And all of these gods of different shapes and sizes occupy slots in the same shared temple compound. So there's the broader compound, and within that compound, there are gods that were worshipped by different caste groups. There were gods with different requirements, and the priest has to attend to all of these people. We even have a round stone because a great-great-grandaunt of mine got bit by a dog and died of rabies. And then they sort of apparently she came back to haunt us, so they took her spirit and put it in a round stone. And when we were kids, that round stone was also lying around, and we'd sort of jump through the hoop and things like that. So it's again a spectrum ranging from ancestor worship, ghosts and people and divinities you're scared of, all the way to the notion of the abstract monotheistic god. As Hindus are often asked, you know, they did believe in one god, but they also believe that that one god could appear in multiple shapes and forms, which always confused the Christian missionary who came into India because they couldn't get their head around that way of perceiving religion.
Sure, and we'll get to the Christians in a second. I mean, I like your description of rivers for two reasons. One, of course, the central role they play within Hinduism itself, both the physical and the mystical rivers, but also from the standpoint of origin and destination. I mean, when you have a river, you know it began somewhere, usually at a higher elevation, maybe in a mountain, comes down and then ends up flowing into a larger body of water. That shows a pathway. How does Hinduism fit into the pathway when you're talking about it from the standpoint of rivers? So
many of the greatest rivers in the world often begin as small streams atop some mountain in places that are obscure. People are often underwhelmed when they go to the source of rivers. And I think I have a quote somewhere in that chapter about how to look for the source of rivers is often a very disappointing proposition because it's nothing as grand as people think. The river becomes grander as you go down as opposed to at its origin, as opposed to the original fount. And Hinduism is one of those things where it is a confluence of different streams and then it becomes something that you can recognize as one united religious formation. But then again, there are further streams flowing out of it. So there are things coming in, and then there are things branching out as well. And all of them ultimately end up in the sea or end up in this common space. So I think that's why I use the river analogy in the book, because it helps explain the diversity and the plurality of origins, which you don't recognizably see in other religions. You know, whether you have a prophet, where you have a book, whereas in Hinduism, we don't have a prophet. We don't have one set of codes. We talk about the Vedas, recognized as the most sort of supreme scripture of Hinduism. But the average Hindu has very little to do with the Vedas to this day. You know, it is a very small segment of people, Brahmins, and within the Brahmins, only a scholarly elite who have access to the Vedas. Everybody else functions in a lived Hinduism that is very different. And that includes, as I said, all kinds of different elements that have come from different streams. And I think that picking and choosing is something that comes very easily to Hinduism. You can go to God A to achieve certain ends and purposes. You can go to Goddess B to achieve something else. You know, in India, we have this notion of arranged marriages, right? And especially with daughters, you know, if your daughter is past 20 and in most places and somehow she isn't married, then parents start fussing and getting anxious. And if your daughter, God forbid, she approaches the age of 30, that's the end of everything. So then there are temples where you go in order to get, you know, boons from God so your daughters and your sons can get married. There are temples you go to because there are diseases you want cured. And by the way, this allows Hindus to also go up to saints from other religions. So there are Christian saints, for example, who in India have been Hinduized almost like Hindu deities and have been associated with specific cures or specific causes. And there are Hindus who happily go to these Christian, you know, saints. They go to these Muslim dargahs, etc. We have gods. There's somewhere in Punjab, I think there's a place where people go and offer clocks because this particular god is supposedly very good at servicing visa applications. So if you want a visa for America or Canada, this god is the person you go to. And the clock, I think, is a, you know, to get your visa on time. I think there's a clock offering that you can make. There's a story I tell about the district I come from in Kerala, in Alappi, where we have a deity who's called Murugan. And there's a story that there was a young boy who was unwell, and his parents were told that you must take him to the temple and make an offering to the deity. Now, typically, offerings to the deity are flowers, and there are some traditional things that you give in a temple. But this kid apparently offered a Munch chocolate. And Munch is this wrapper, you know, that's a particular brand of chocolate. And he was cured by the next morning. And since then, this deity has been called Munch Murugan. Because now everybody who goes to the temple offers Munch. There are garlands made out of Munch. We have this ceremony called Tulabharam, where you weigh yourself in coconuts or grain or whatever and donate it to the temple. People do that with the Munch chocolate now. And therefore, this god is now called Munch Murugan. So there's a whole variety of sometimes... To the rest of the world, it may seem a bit bewildering, but to Hinduism, I think it's a very dynamic process. It's still a religion that's evolving.
I mean,
because it's so conditioned by history, it's easy for it to evolve that way.
Sure. I mean, that sort of sets the mind space. I mean, to me, I don't have an issue with the theological regarding the Munch chocolate, but a more practical thing, India's hot and chocolate melts.
Oh, it does.
Is that something that's rectified?
Well, it's in the wrappers, so it's not messy.
How silly of me. I should have gone.
You don't take it out of the wrapper. It has to go with the Munch wrapper.
Say, I wouldn't
come
do
to
well.
Come Kerala, I'll take you.
I'm kind of a Twix man myself, but okay, I'll change for you. So, you know, you describe it, I think, in this wonderful way that some might see that Hinduism is a study of contradiction because it could be this and it could be not this. You write in the book that India is a civilization that's raised up on astute compromises. Is that the key to success, that this is not about clashing, it is not about a convergence which then erases the non-dominant one? And how do those compromises then play themselves out within what I would guess called, as you said, lived or applied Hinduism?
Can I give you an example from my own family temple? So we had our main gods in the big temple, where my mother's family, they had land, they had resources. And because everything in India, there's this whole caste element, right? So in an agrarian community, you have the main family that holds all the land. Then you've got your staff, people who work for you. And then there are people of a marginalized caste community who used to actually till the fields. And because of caste taboos, they weren't allowed to come near the house. They weren't allowed to enter the temple. They had their forms of worship in local groves. One of these groups was called the Kauravas. And till my great-great-grandparents' generation, there was at least one family of Kauravas who still lived somewhere on the edges of this property. And they say my great-great-grandfather is the one who evicted them from there. But clearly he was afraid of their god because they had a deity called Airaveli Munodi. And while he evicted them, he took their god and the god was placed inside the temple. There's another group called the Pulayar. Now the Pulayar had their animal sacrifices and forms of worship that they performed in a different grove. But after a period of time, they abandoned that deity. And we again took that deity and brought that deity into the temple. So the people who worshipped that deity are gone. They no longer have any interest in worshipping this deity. But we cannot do anything unless that deity is also satisfied. So the deity is kept there. And because this deity at one point required alcohol as part of his worship rituals, before we start our so-called pure vegetarian rituals in the temple, you have to make an offering of alcohol somewhere outside the temple. So in my teens, I remember seeing my uncles, you know, in a black polythene bag in a very hush-hush way, handing over alcohol to somebody because you have to sort of, you know, a tip of the hat to that old custom has to be made even now, even though the god has now been absorbed into the main temple and doesn't actually consume alcohol anymore. So the god's form is also changing, and that's still happening in front of us. We have deities of tribal origin, and you have essentially Hindu nationalist groups who are a bit paranoid that these groups might convert to Christianity because the missionary remains a threat in parts of India and the tribal belt. So they'll go and interpret these gods as forms of Hindu gods. So it's a way of saying that we don't deny the existence of your gods, but we'll just connect them to our grand narrative of who these gods are. We have cases where you have, say, for example, in a place called Madurai in Tamil Nadu, you have a goddess who in her original legend is this androgynous triple-breasted goddess, a warrior princess and all of that, and was clearly a local goddess at some point. But she was a very important goddess. So once Brahminical culture came into the picture. They got her married to Shiva, again, a mainstream Hindu male god. And through the marriage, she became a form of this goddess called Parvati. She's actually a local goddess originally, but she can now also be interpreted as a form of this other goddess, thereby linking the two without having to actually physically, you know, transform anything. So there are all kinds of compromises, negotiations. There's a lot of navigation of this. There are temples where in the same deity at different times of the day is worshipped in different forms. So the image is the same, but in the morning it's the goddess Lakshmi, in the evening it might be the goddess Parvati. There are temples where the afternoon pujas are done by Brahmin priests in one way, but the morning and evening pujas are done by non-Brahmin priests in a different way. Because the idea is that everybody has a claim to this divine space, but everybody will also worship this deity in different ways. Even in major temples, one of our biggest pilgrim centers is this temple called Srirangam. There the deity has a Muslim wife, because there's this whole legend about how when the first Islamic invasions into South India took place, the temple legend tells us that the armies from Delhi swept into southern India. They took away one of the images of the god. The devotees from this temple went all the way to the Sultan's court in Delhi, persuaded him to return the idol of their deity. The only problem was that the Sultan's daughter, according to temple legend, had picked up this god and she was playing with it like you would play with a doll. Except that Indian temple chronicles are often very naughty as well, because they also have this line in it which, where they say that while she played with the deity as a doll during the day, at night the deity took human form and played other games. So you can make what you will of that. But the point is,
I don't know. I'm
you're very innocent.
I'm innocent. Yeah.
We'll excuse that. I won't.
No, your mind. I mean you're here to educate me.
I'm not going to corrupt your mind. But the point is, she was playing with it.
I tried.
She was playing with it as she would play with a doll, which is to dress it, to bathe it, to feed it, etc. And essentially, this is what we do to temple idols in temples. You wake up deities, you dress them, you get them married, you take them out in processions, you put them to bed. We even have goddesses who menstruate in India, and their post-menstrual baths are major festivals. In fact, there's a place called Chengannur, again in my home state, where the cloth of the deity, where the menstrual spot appears on the idol, that used to be auctioned to people at some point, apparently. There used to be a waiting list to get that cloth, because that cloth was considered sacred. So deities go through all of these human emotions, but at a very different scale. So she was essentially venerating the deity by playing with it as she would with a doll. So when the deity was handed back to the priests and made his way back to Srirangam, this Muslim princess from Delhi, according to the legend, followed. When she got here, they had hidden away the deity because they didn't want him to go back to Delhi again. So she collapsed in the pangs of separation and she died. So then the deity said, look, I've accepted her as my consort. She needs to be given space inside the temple. So we actually have a corner in this very, very high caste, very important Hindu temple in southern India for a Muslim woman who's recognized as the Muslim spouse of this Hindu god. So if you can absorb even Islam and Christianity, etc., into your worldview, you can imagine that you can absorb all kinds of other local cults and traditions. In fact, as late as the 18th century, some Hindu sources did try to give Islam Hindu origins by saying that it was the god Shiva who gave permission to the prophet Muhammad to create a new faith, to target a different set of people and a new audience. So Hindus have definitely tried to absorb Christianity and Islam also into the fold, but it didn't quite work out.
Yeah, I'm sure that went well with the mosques. You know, you mentioned the arrival of Islam in India, and it takes on a few different forms. You have Muhammad bin Qasim coming in, the first sort of military force in 711, but it doesn't stay. Mahmud of Ghazni in the late 11th century, and then of course you have the Delhi Sultanate, the 13th century. You also have traders in 699 and, you know, the middle of the 7th century coming to the Malabar coast, including, as you obviously know, Kerala. Here you have a society in India that, if you were to ask them, what are you? They'll just say, I don't understand the question. I am just who I am, ontologically. But now, dealing with these external forces coming, part of the process becomes you being compelled to define yourself. And oftentimes that self-definition becomes not just simply what you are, but what you're not. So your book touches on this process and this tension with various interventions that are external. And so I'd like to go through both the Islamic intervention and then the European. In the Islamic one, you mentioned that Islam's arrival in India disrupts Brahmanism. And how is that?
So Islam, as you alluded to, in the north of India, Islam came on the back of armies. So in the north, it was much more violent. There were invasions. There were cases of forced conversion of people, etc. So it was a much more traumatic affair in the north, which is why to this day, if you look at the geographical sort of spread of Hindu nationalism and a kind of animosity towards Islam in terms of cultural consciousness, a lot of it is sort of focused in northern India, because their memories of the arrival of Islam in some ways is also linked to memories of invasion and conquest and loss. In the south, because of maritime networks, Islam came through peaceful embassies of commerce. And the way they came in, they adapted to local culture. There was no conflict there in the way it happened in the north. So, for example, in Kerala, again, which is on the southwestern coast of India, you find that Islamic Muslim families and Muslim elites adopted the local system of matrilineal succession. So again, my part of the world, we have the matrilineal system. You belong to your mother's family. You belong to your mother's caste. You inherit from the mother. And the father is essentially a non-entity. You know, we have my grandfather never knew his father's name, because he knew his father, but he had no idea what his father's parents were like, because there was no involvement in that sense. And local Muslims in Kerala also became matrilineal. They became part of the same cultural fabric, where their mosques were essentially built by the same masons, the same carpenters who built temples, as a result of which both structures look very similar. We have temple legends where the Muslim is a familiar presence. You know, there's a particular temple where the goddess is supposed to have come by sea, and her captain of the ship was a Muslim, because Muslims were associated with seafaring and trading, and therefore he's seen as a benign figure there. So the northern experience or the southern experience is slightly different. But because in the north, Islam came with power, and Delhi and the big empire in the north was an Islamic empire, that's when power comes in and sort of changes the equation. That's when there is the creation of an us versus them. Because now you have a dominant elite that believes in a different worldview, that belongs to a different faith, and that elite draws a distinction between who they are and who you are. And in a way, that reinforces your sense of being separate as well. So already by the 14th century, we have Hindu kings using the word Hindu for themselves. Hinduism is one of those religions where the word Hindu originally doesn't come from India. It's people outside India who describe the people in India as Hindus, or people who live beyond the Indus River or beyond the Sindhu River. That's essentially the origin of the word Hindu. But Hindus appropriate the term by the 14th century and start applying it to themselves. You start seeing poets like, you know, Kabir, who was a weaver. He talks about Turks and Hindus as in two master categories, the Muslim and the Hindu. This is not to say that either is a monolith, because the Muslim in southern India is not the same as the Muslim in North India. The matrilineal Muslim in Kerala will scandalize the Muslim in central India, who was also scandalized by the Muslim of Kashmir, because their Islam had different cultural inflections and flavors. Similarly, the Hindu is also not a monolith. It's very diverse. Yet you can see there are two broad camps emerging. And I think power and the presence of the other, the presence of a hostile figure in the room, can sometimes trigger a greater awareness of identity. As one analogy I use in the book is that, you know, four brown people in a room won't really think of their brownness as anything, because for them it's normal. They're just four people. But the moment there's a white man in the room, and the white man happens to have a stick in his hand, then brownness becomes a means to articulate a joint defense against the presence of a new figure. The benign white figure is fine. They'll still recognize some difference, but it's the presence of the stick that makes the white figure a threatening.
If instead of the stick, he's coming with a wallet, then you might find a similar stratification in order to gain greater favor with the person with the wallet.
Yeah.
But the process, I think, that you're saying is right. So this fascinates me then, that the term Hindu is one that is then internalized by the population,
who we now call Hindus,
but a term that was ascribed to them from outside. And in that sense, it seems as though it's a very unique situation. Judaism is self-defined. Christian is self-defined. Muslim is self-defined. I mean, with the exception of, you know, being called Mohammedan or Saracen or some of those, and we'll talk about Orientalism in a middle. How do you think that idea of being defined from without then has shaped Hindu identity? I mean, I know we can talk about it in the contemporary, but in this place that you're talking about of the 14th century and all.
There was for a long time an academic argument that Hinduism was an invented religion, and that was largely invented in the colonial or the modern period, because there's so much stress on this outside influence. It's outsiders looking in that are creating the contours and the shape of Hinduism, which we now live with. But that argument, as a 21-year-old, when I wrote my master's dissertation on Hinduism, I was sort of persuaded by that argument to a certain degree, but it never fully convinced me because I thought it takes away agency from the people being invented. Exactly. You know, they're obviously buying into this as well because they recognize something there already, which is why earlier when I said that Brahminical culture, creating that framework is essential to understanding how Hinduism emerges, because if an outsider came and gave the word Hindu to the people living in India, and if the people took it, it's because they recognized something of value there because they already had something there that was familiar to them. It's like the word India or Indian, right? Nobody in India was going around calling the place India. Nobody in India was going around calling themselves Indians. But the moment that word came into currency and came into popular usage, we absorbed it and we took it over very easily because we recognized that there was something that that word represented and we had meaning for it. So the word could be borrowed very easily. As early as Alexander's invasion of India, when his people asked apparently four sadhus or hermits from India what their homeland was, they said it was from the Indus River to the Bay of Bengal and from the northern Himalayas to the tip of the subcontinent and the southern seas. So they had a clear sense of this space being some kind of a cultural zone, which meant that when the word India came in, it was easy for them to adapt to that term. And I think it's the same with Hinduism. When the outsider looked in and created this word or used this word and then came into power in India, you know, the Islamic power in India and northern India, it was easy for these Hindus to sort of appropriate the term for themselves and use it in a self-referential kind of way.
But it wasn't then a threat to power, the fact that they were using the term.
I think there was some politics to it.
Of course there was power, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the one place on earth that there's no Indian food, right?
Is there such a place?
Yeah. Anyone know? It's India, because they just call it food. But
actually, we fight over local variants of food. There's a big debate in India, you know, there's a thing called sambar that we make and everyone's trying to figure out where it originated and nobody's very convinced by the answers. We also fight over desserts and which state and which part of the country actually invented specific desserts. So yeah, we're busy fighting.
Well, we'll get into the whole thing about when people claim that jalebi and gulab jamun came from Turkey and then it becomes global. The other big intervention, of course, is the Europeans. And along with that, you have the Orientalist gaze. Yeah. I always found it interesting that when Edward Said, who of course wrote the seminal work Orientalism, he pretty much stops at the Middle East and the Islamicate. Yeah. But there's clearly Orientalism that is applied to the subcontinent. And interestingly enough, one can argue by Muslims as well as by Europeans. In the European context, I mean, I think it goes without saying that it caused damage. But how did it then affect the contours of Hinduism and of Hindu identity?
So when the first Europeans came in, of course, they came in from a worldview where they had a lot of outdated and often false information from Greek sources that were 1,000 years old. For example, Marco Polo quite confidently at one point claimed, people thought that there were groups in India who had the bodies of men and the heads of dogs. And Marco Polo in his account, I think somewhere mentions that he saw the people of the Andaman Islands just off the west coast of India, and they specifically resembled mastiffs from here. And I thought that was very specific for him to have claimed that. But in reality, India obviously didn't have people with dogs' heads and all of that. To be fair, Indians also had their cliches about Europeans and white people. For example, as late as 1803, there was in northern India a Raja who thought all white people looked like pigs, and they had long ears in which they wrapped themselves up at night and went to bed. Indians were very upset when Europeans came in to civilize them because they thought these are people who don't wash their bottoms after going to the toilet and here they are to civilize us. There was also this rumor that, you know, Europeans like to eat babies fried in butter. So that was the third Indian cliche about white people. But the white interlopers and interlocutors talking to Hindus who first came in after the Portuguese sailed into the Indian Ocean, they came with a lot of baggage. One was, of course, religious baggage because they came from a world where God had revealed himself through the Bible. The Bible was the path to God. Christianity was the religion in the world. So necessarily anybody who wasn't Christian and anybody who wasn't worshiping God via the Bible was worshiping something else, something satanic, something devilish. And there was a kind of prehistory to this in Europe itself. As Christianity spread through Europe, say Scandinavia and parts, even in Britain, there were times when they thought that image worship, paganism, is essentially satanic. You're worshipping Satan, you're not worshipping the actual God, because the actual God is Christian. And that is the lens they bring to India. So I actually have an image here, which, you know, they come to India and they look at Indian gods and they're convinced that all these gods and idols that they're seeing are demons. They're all forms of Satan. The image here on the left, on your right, I think, is a devil called Diomus or Diomo in Calicut. Now, Calicut is again my home state, and I know exactly why this devil was called Diomo, because in the Malayalam language, the word for God is Devam. And someone, if a European traveler, heard this word Devam, turned it into Diomo the devil, and suddenly you have the God of Calicut presented this way, with rooster's feet and claws and this, you know, and fangs and things like that. Whereas if you go there, you'll find the deity has a very different appearance. So like the image on the right, that's actually a form of the Hindu god Vishnu, where he emerges from a pillar to rip this villain of a story. But they obviously saw these images and they thought, this can't be God, right? Somebody who rips apart a human being can't be God. That has to be devilish. So they were looking at Indian subjects through European lens, and we're convinced that they were looking at idolatry, paganism, and devil worship. To which, of course, the Indians would also argue back. For example, there were these debates in the courts of these Rajas where they tell these Christian missionaries coming in that, look, you're saying you're accusing us of idolatry, but what about your processions to the Virgin Mary? What about that? Isn't that a form of idolatry? Then they'd say that, you know, this notion of the virgin birth, that doesn't make sense to us. So each time the outsider had his baggage and his bag of cliches to apply against the Hindus would find a way to sort of reciprocate and ask questions in the reverse as well. But yes, there was a gaze that the outsider brought in where they saw all Hindu gods as essentially devilish forms, as forms of Satan. And sometimes they concocted images like this. There actually isn't a god like this in Calicut. Sometimes it was also just words being misused. I remember when I was doing my first book, there's this reference, I think, among the Dutch or the Portuguese, where they say the king of Calicut is possessed by a devil called Paredevada. And actually, Paredevada is nothing but the Malayalam word Paradevata, which means family god. He was worshipping his family god, but they wrote that down as he's been possessed by a devil called Paredevada. So you can see exactly what's happening. The intention here is X to Y, whereas the way it's interpreted is in a completely different direction, because the interpreter has a certain worldview in which this cannot be a path to God. The situation becomes complicated. Initially, the Hindus are just amused. They're just having these debates with Christians. One point that they make in different parts of the country, and which the European, you know, interlocutor never understands, is that the Hindus' argument always is that God has created multiple ways to heaven. So the Hindus are willing to recognize Christianity and the Bible. They're willing to admire Jesus as well. But they're willing to recognize it as one path to God, not the path to God. And you see this case being made in the 16th century, in the 17th century, in the 18th century, down to early Hindu nationalists in the 20th century. One of the first people to define Hindu nationalism in the early 20th century was a man called Tilak. And he actually says, to be a Hindu, you have to believe in multiple paths to God, not one path to God. There's this, the first Protestant missionary is a man called Ziegenbach. And he says, no, you know, God has created only one way to God. And they say, no. God is like a shopkeeper. You know, just as a shopkeeper or a store owner has multiple products on his counter to attract all kinds of buyers, God has also created multiple options for people to come. When Ziegenbach says that's not possible, you know, everybody has to end up in the same place, they say that's not possible. The world is full of so many races. If we're all going to end up in the same heaven, how are we talking to each other? What are the diversity practices in heaven? You know, how are people, what languages are people using in heaven? And in any case, if I'm damned in your religion, you know, as well as damned in mine, might as well stay in my religion instead of converting. Why go through the inconvenience of baptism when, you know, it's going to be end up all the same anyway? So their fundamental disagreement was on this question of, are there multiple paths to God or is it just one path to God? And the reason the Hindus kept arguing for multiple paths wasn't because they were somehow wiser or more cosmopolitan, but as we were discussing earlier, because Hinduism is an amalgamation of so many traditions, multiple paths is something that is very internal to Hinduism. For every Hindu, there is a distinct path. My Hinduism may not be somebody else's Hinduism there. The way temple practice is done in Kerala is not the way it may be done in northern India. The way the goddess is worshipped in one region may not be how she's worshipped in the next. So when Hinduism itself is made up of multiple paths, its approach to other religions was also to say that you are a path, not the path. And that was the point of conflict between the two.
When you have in the New Testament, I'm the light, the way, the truth, and the way, no one comes to the Lord but through me. That doesn't exactly allow for other rivers to flow.
Although the last pope in Singapore did say at an interaction with young people that there are, you know, different religions are like different languages. They're all different forms of expressing a desire to reach the same destination or something along those lines. And I did notice that in a lot of conservative Catholic circles that sparked a lot of umbrage. They said, this is against what Jesus said, you know, exactly the quote that you used, that, you know, he is the path to God. You cannot claim that all paths are equal paths.
Yeah.
So I found it amusing that 500 years after the Hindus first made this case, the Pope himself did ultimately in a way, acknowledge it in Singapore.
He caught up. So you mentioned Tilak. And fast forward now to more relatively contemporary times, and that is the British intervention, more specifically than just the European with the French and the Portuguese and all. And it comes to India in two ways. First, as a corporate imperative through the British East India Company, and then at a time when you had Mughal power, and then that is dismantled. And then in 1857, you have the British intervention by the Crown. And you start to see these movements emerge. You have somebody like Dayananda Saraswati, who is the founder of the Arya Samaj, who you describe as a Hindu evangelical movement. You have people like Jyotiba Phule, you have Rajaram Mohan Roy. And I found it fascinating that you described them as Martin Luther's.
Native Luthers.
Yeah,
they were
native,
all called
native
that.
Luthers, yeah. And this is something that, again, the Western Orientalist gaze, I mean, even today you hear people saying, where's the Muslim Martin Luther? Yeah. And I always ask when I'm in an audience, I said, okay, if I'm invited to a church, I always ask the question, well, what's your denomination? And they're like, well, why does it matter? I said, well, if you're Catholics, then Luther's a villain. And if you're Protestant, then depending on where you are, he's kind of a hero. But the idea that there's a consciousness that is developing in reaction to this shift in political power that is brought about by occupation, that is brought about by disempowerment. How is that now starting through people like Tilak and Gokhale, which were the predecessors of the more famous, thanks to the movie Gandhi, Indian independence leaders, I mean, Nehru, Gandhi, Bose, Patel, Jinnah, etc.?
I think power is a very important part of the story. Religion isn't purely about faith. Faith is one element in it. But religious identities are often created because of situations of power imbalance, etc. You alluded to that earlier as well. For example, the Catholic missionaries who first came to India, very quickly they realized that they were only able to convert marginalized sections of Indian society, the lowest castes, really. And they weren't very pleased with that because then they had this fear that the Bible would get tainted as something only for low-born people, and they wanted high-born Hindus to also convert. So the result was that at a time before European colonialism was strong, when Hindus still held power in India, in southern India especially, it was actually Christianity that adapted to Hinduism and in some ways Hinduized itself. I have a compelling figure in the book called Roberto de Nobili. He was this Italian Jesuit, comes into inland Tamil Nadu, into a temple town called Madurai. And in Madurai, he realizes that to convert high caste Hindus to Christianity, he has to make Christianity acceptable and attractive to them. So he essentially... The Hindu Brahmin wears a sacred thread around his torso. Nobili wears a sacred thread around his torso with the difference that there's a cross attached to it. Every time he converts an upper caste person, he says, you can come into the church and you can retain your caste. I will give you a fresh sacred thread with a cross on it, and you will sit in the front of the church and lower caste Christians will sit at the back of the church. To this day in Tamil Nadu, the Catholic Church has separate cemeteries for lower caste Christians versus upper caste Christians. Upper caste Christians can perform certain rituals in the church, which lower caste Christians cannot, to this day. So caste was internalized into Christianity. There were shrines where, just as you do goat sacrifices to the Hindu goddess Kali, thanks to De Nobili and this sort of Hinduizing of the Catholic Church, you do goat sacrifices to Christian saints. Because when power was in native hands, as it were, it was Christianity that had to adapt and come up with a response in which it Hinduized itself. De Nobili even went to the extent of eating only vegetarian food, sitting on the floor cross-legged like a Brahmin, dressed in Brahmin or the saffron robes that a Hindu sannyasi or a Hindu holy man wears, to the extent that he went to Goa at one point to see his superiors and he refused to eat with them, saying that I'm not play-acting. I genuinely believe I'm a Brahmin from Italy here to give them the fifth Veda. So the Hindus had their four sacred Vedas and he presented the Bible as the fifth Veda. You've got four steps on the ladder to God. Great. I'm here with the fifth and the final step. That's how he presented Hinduism. There's a Marathi writer who actually uses the expression where he says that it's essentially like keeping the infrastructure of the temple exactly as it is. The only difference is you remove the Hindu image from inside and replace it with an image of Jesus. So instead of demanding that all Hindus take a new route to God, you allow them to walk on their path, and it's only in the final mile that you create a slight deviation and you lead them to the Bible. Because of power. Power was in Hindu hands, therefore Christianity had to move to Hindu terms. Even when the East India Company first came into India, we live in Britain. In Britain at the moment, there's this whole polarizing debate about colonialism, right? It's this extreme. One set of people will argue that colonialism spread democracy around the world, brought the railways around the world. The other will say it was all oppression and this and that. But it's actually a little bit more complex, because when the East India Company first came in, not only were they tolerant of Hinduism, initially they actively seemed to endorse Hinduism. You have company officials of the East India Company making donations to Hindu temples because this was a way of getting in with Hindu society. The richest temple in India is the Tirupati temple. It has an endowment or a donation from Thomas Munro, a famous Scotsman. Padmanabha Swami, one of the richest temples in the world, $22 billion worth of treasure sitting in its vaults, has jewels donated by a man called Colonel John Munro. Madurai, there are these stirrups, I think, made of bejeweled stirrups, which were donated by an English official called Roos Peter. Those menstrual bath processions of goddesses, it was English company officials leading some of these processions. You know, they were performing rituals just as Hindu rajas would perform Hindu rituals. Company officials stepped into their shoes and they would perform those rituals. That was the initial response to it. And the Hindus also reciprocated. The Hindus also made way for the white man to figure in their notion of what the world looked like. But when the power balance started to shift and the white man became more and more secure, pressure started building up here in Parliament, because the 19th century was also the great evangelical age here, you know, just before the Victorian period. So Parliament started getting a lot of petitions and a lot of pressure from this evangelical movement here, saying that it is your job to take the Christian light to the East. It is your job to send missionaries into the East. The East India Company did not want missionaries. They tried everything they could to keep the missionary at bay. But because pressure was built up in London and Parliament had to give way, eventually the missionary was permitted entry. That is when you start seeing that the Hindus begin to recognize Christianity and the missionary as more of a threat. And of course, they have inventive ways of doing this. One very memorable story that I relate in the book is how now that Christianity has come into their worldview, they need to give it some space, that they've decided to give it negative space. So what they say is that, you know, all the Hindu traditions were doing so well that all the Hindu souls were ending up in heaven as opposed to hell. Because of this, hell faced a depopulation. There was nobody left in hell. And because God is all about cosmic balance in the Hindu imagination, obviously hell also needed a certain number of people. So to waylay some people into going into hell, God created Christianity so that some souls would end up in the wrong place. So they created room for Christianity in their worldview, but it was a negative kind of space. Similarly, there were these big public Ramlila performances where the Ramayana story, the great epic, would be enacted. And people started noticing that the effigy of Ravana, you know, there's a flaming arrow at the end that sort of shot at the effigy and it goes up in flames. Suddenly, the effigy of Ravana was wearing the clothes of the English East India Company Governor General. So clearly, something was happening. Hindus were getting a bit anxious about the presence of the white man in the country. So initially, when power is on the Hindu side, it is the Christian who's adapting. But when the power dynamic shifts and it feels like the white man now has disproportionate control, then Hindus start responding. And to your question about the native Luthers, it is at this point that Hindus start giving Hinduism a new mold that can stand up to pressure from the West. So all of the people you're mentioning, this man called Dayananda Saraswati essentially borrows the evangelical movement and their formula and creates a Hindu evangelical movement. So if the missionary goes out to convert Hindus to Christianity, his organization, the Arya Samaj, sends out people to reconvert them back to Hinduism. Of course, it has strange byproducts also. There was this Hindu Maharaja who fell in love with a married woman in southern India. In those days, there was no divorce for Hindus. So the lady converted to Islam. Automatically, her connection with her first husband was severed. The moment that was confirmed, she went to an Arya Samaj center and got reconverted to Hinduism and married the Maharaja that she wanted to marry. So you have the borrowing of the missionaries' tools by Hindus to sort of reinvent their religion, but also to keep the missionary at bay. This has an intellectual attempt where, for example, somebody like Ram Mohan Roy borrows the Protestant mold. He takes the Protestant argument, which is that there was pristine Christianity of the scripture. Then the Catholic Church corrupts it. Then you have a Protestant Reformation, and then you have good Christianity emerging from that. That framework he applies to Hinduism. He says we had an esoteric version of Hinduism in which God was just an abstract entity. We didn't have temples, we didn't have idols, because idol worship was something missionaries attacked a lot. The Brahmins corrupted Hinduism into a form of idol worship and temple worship. And people like him would, like Martin Luther, create a Reformation of sorts, a Protestantization of Hinduism to go back to that original form of Christianity. So this quest for original, pure Hinduism in the 19th century comes from that Protestant gaze, which they've appropriated partly also to keep the Protestant missionary away. And Ram Mohan Roy actually says that, you know, if it comes to conversion, with the Christians, you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You're still dividing God into three, whereas the Advaita Vedantic version of Hinduism says God is beyond division and God has no form. So he says, instead of converting to Christianity, we just need to go back to our original faith. So he takes the missionary's path to a certain extent, weaponizes the missionary's own weapons for his own cause, and then creates a newly sort of rebranded version of Hinduism. But also on the colonialism point, which I was saying earlier, that is a little bit more complex. Colonial dynamics also allowed a lot of marginalized group Hindus themselves to stand up to oppression within, which is why the third person you mentioned, Phule, for example, he wasn't terribly afraid of the British. He wasn't terribly anti-British. In fact, people often critiqued him as anti-national because he thought British rule in India had allowed for the first time lower caste communities to come together to mobilize politically and stand up for themselves. And that's true. As late as the early 20th century, we had people in southern India in the non-Brahmin movement arguing that actually we prefer British rule because if the British go, then it'll again be upper caste Hindus dominating. One is not taking sides here, but it's interesting to see that none of these debates are easy to sort of get your head around. There's so many things happening in parallel. There are Englishmen with contempt for India, but there are also Englishmen with great curiosity and love for Indian culture. There are English officials romanticizing ancient India, translating Sanskrit texts and things like that. And there are Indians who are completely in love with the English language and want to use the English language to get Western technology. There's all of this happening at the same time. So any simplistic narrative, either about this religious interaction or about colonialism, is simplistic, ultimately, and is not giving you the full picture.
I think it goes back to the point that you make early in the book that this is a civilization of astute compromise and recognizing that. With that, I'd like to open it up to questions from you. We have, I think, a couple of roving mics, so please, if you want to indicate to our wonderful staff. Yes, we have a question up here, and then we've got two back there after that.
Thank you. This is absolutely fascinating. I'm really excited about reading your book. And the question I have is just something you were touching on there about power and power within Hindu culture. And, you know, to what extent, I think you started off presenting Hinduism as a very inclusive form of religion, but obviously there are power differentials within that, and it's actually quite exclusionary.
Yeah.
Could you say a bit about how that has developed over time?
So there's a quote I have in the book, which by a scholar called Arvind Sharma, where he essentially says that Hinduism isn't, traditionally speaking, in the way it sort of absorbed all these cultures, while absorbing them, it was not promoting equality. It wanted equilibrium between all of these different slots, but at the same time, it was also creating a hierarchy. So you have room for everybody to exist, but there is a hierarchy in which each of those elements or each of those constituents is placed. And I think that's why we have this slightly contradictory situation where it's tolerant. It'll absorb everything, it'll endorse everything, it'll make room for everything. But at the same time, it will not acknowledge that all are equal. Some are higher and some are lower. So it's one of those strange contradictions of Hinduism, which is why to this day, I think Hindu society struggles with caste. Because although there are people, even in the Hindu nationalist movement, who recognize this one uniform overarching Hindu identity and want to mobilize politically with it, caste remains a fragility for this modern Hindu identity. Because if you're going to treat me as low and somebody else as high, and you won't even eat my food, my shadow pollutes you and things like that, then are we really members of the same faith? And caste was therefore used often by the missionary to sort of puncture elements in the Hindu narrative. So I think you're right, the lack of equality does remain a bit of a problem and a contradiction within. But it's always been the case because historically, when it absorbed the many, it never made the claim that the many would be equal, that there would always be a level of inequality in where each of those constituents was placed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I look forward to reading the book. I was hoping you could expand a little bit more on the role of the agency of these Hindu reformers in the 19th and 20th centuries in terms of creating a modern idea of Hindu religion, because obviously the sort of academic scholarship has predominantly said in the last sort of 20, 30 years that it's the category of religion itself, in a way, the idea of what a religion is, and then this idea of world religions, yeah. And they're sort of seen as discrete traditions. They each have, as you were saying earlier, you know, an identifiable founder, a canonized body of scripture, maybe some kind of universal religious practices and so on and so forth. And somehow this is attached to the idea of Hinduism. But as you say, you want to say this is, I'd be interested to know how this is more a co-creation rather than a sort of a imposition of a sort of Eurocentric colonial framework.
I think you've in a sense already answered it, which is it is a co-creation. So although the concepts have come in from the West, essentially white man's power has grown in India, the white man is now a threat, and the missionary looks like a threat. So these Hindu reformers were very self-conscious reformers. We've had lots of interesting figures in Hindu history who've stood up against caste, who've done interesting new things in Hinduism. But none of them actively thought of themselves as reformers as these 19th century figures did. Because the 19th century figures emerged in a very specific power dynamic where they were very aware that what they were doing was also political. So they were appropriating concepts from the West and acknowledging that those concepts had meaning and value for them. But they were doing it in order to reinforce and sort of fortify their own position as opposed to giving in to what the West wanted. So as I said, for example, if you take Ram Mohan Roy, his earliest writing in the Persian language is actually very radical. He says that there could only have been one God. That God could not have created contradictory prescriptions. For example, Islam does not endorse image worship, but Hindus believe in image worship. So clearly these are man-made notions, and God could not have mandated these rules. So there is one God, but religion itself is a matter of human invention, was Ram Mohan Roy's original position. But a few years later, he writes essentially in these very words, where he says that the current political condition of the Hindus doesn't allow them to sort of stand up to the British, etc. So he needs to reinvigorate and sort of redo and rebrand Hinduism in a way that will allow Hindu society to stand up. In that, he appropriates this Protestant mold of thinking, applies it to Hinduism, and creates the sort of, you know, whitewashed, detached version of Hinduism. So it's a process where he has agency to an extent in appropriating that Western concept, but he's not a doormat. He's not allowing the white man to come and dictate the terms and how he's going to use it. To give you another analogy, the English language, right? The English language was brought into India partly for the British government's administrative convenience. The Indians picked up the English language, but with the English language, they also picked up the jargon of democracy and rights and things like that from Britain, and then use and deploy the English language against the British presence in India. So you're essentially borrowing the grammar book of your colonizer to fight the colonizer. It's like Gandhi, you know, Gandhi hated the railways. He thought the railways were a very bad thing. But he traveled extensively through the railways, and every time his train stopped somewhere, all he had to do was appear at the door of the railway carriage, and that platform of the railway station would become a political platform, and it'd give a speech. So he was subverting something the British created by using it, except he was using it for his own purposes. But this is not to say that it was purely in exchange with the white man that this happened. The other figure in the 19th century that I highlight is this man called Dayananda Saraswati. His questions emerged from within. You know, there's a story about how he was a young boy, and there's this festival called Shivaratri, where you keep vigil at night in a temple to Shiva. You're not supposed to sleep. And as a teenage boy, he was part of Shivaratri and he's keeping vigil. But he saw a mouse sort of floating around the idol of the god and eating all the offerings that were kept there. And he said, if this god can't protect himself from a mouse, from a mere rodent, is this stone really God? So it wasn't exposure to the missionary that triggered these questions in him. It was just a very personal experience. Then he travels through India, he meets holy people. At one point, he consumes marijuana to see if his mind in a different plane will give him some answers. It doesn't work. He goes up to the Himalayas, doesn't find answers there. Eventually comes down to the cities, meets people who are anglicized, who are dealing with religion in a new way, and he realizes there are certain benefits here. So he creates a text called the Satyarth Prakash because he realizes the book matters now. He starts using the printing press because he sees that the missionary uses pamphlets and printing to his advantage, and so he's going to do that as well. He creates an organization which, as we were saying earlier, reconverts people from other religions into Hinduism. So again, he's borrowing the missionary's tactics to create a modernized version of Hinduism. And the final person, of course, Phule, he uses the missionary's critique to critique Hinduism's own inequalities within. And this is, again, this has its own long tradition, etc. But in each of these cases, you have Western molds, including the concept of religion and what a religion ought to look like. Yes, that is very much defined by Western minds in a Western frame, but it is appropriated and reused and sort of deployed by Hindus for their own purposes, as opposed to the Hindus sort of accepting it entirely in the way the white man intended. It's like mission schools, right? They always thought that these were evangelistic agencies. So the Hindus would come to mission schools, they'd read, pick up the English language, read Western science, etc. And that would spark doubt in their own minds about their religion, and that would ease the path to conversion. In reality, what happened was Hindus went to these mission schools, read the Bible, but read the Bible as a textbook. And then once they picked up the English language, they got government jobs. Using their government salaries, they built more temples.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question, if you don't mind. I think we got the other question here.
Thank you, Manu. That was eye-opening, I would say. My question is because there's the word modern Hindu identity in your book, where do you see the modern Hindu identity going, especially in the context of how present Indian, the people in power in India want to impose Hindutva identity in India, take out the heterogeneous character of Hinduism and homogenize them, paper over the caste system and make the Muslim and the Christian the bad person and basically kind of political. It's a social engineering program that they're generating. So where do you think the Hindu identity is going? Is there a pushback against it or they're going with the flow? So where do you think in the next 50 years?
So when I was doing the book, I thought the epilogue of the book, just the closing part, would be a sort of commentary on what's happening in the country now. But I decided not to do that because the book ends with Hindutva. The final chapter is about the rise of Hindu nationalism. But the epilogue does not talk about the present because I thought tacitly it's almost playing into that narrative by saying that this is the end product of these 500 years of change, which is to say that Hindutva is the culmination of everything that has happened. But it is, again, a culmination. It is a byproduct, not the byproduct. And we should not make the mistake of assuming that everything we see in the present is the ending of the story. It is not. Because even now, a lot of the pushback is coming from within. Even now, a lot of the pushback is coming from Hindus themselves who do not recognize this homogenized, straitjacketed version of Hinduism. Even today, when you go to the Sabarimala temple, you first stop at the mosque of a man called Vavar, who's supposed to have been a great friend of this Hindu deity. And you, without stopping at the mosque of Vavar, you can't go. There are Hindutva forces who are trying to stop people from doing that. But people still go. Because for the pilgrims, that is very much part of your tradition. You have to stop at the mosque. When I went to Sabarimala, I also stopped at the mosque before I trekked up the hill to go and enter the temple. So a lot of the pushback will happen that way. It will happen quietly. I don't think it's easy to wipe out that kind of heterogeneity because the heterogeneity wasn't invented overnight. It's been built up over many, many centuries. This is not to play down the threat, as it were, because there is technology. You know, people are susceptible to what we call WhatsApp University in India, just misinformation and fake news over WhatsApp, creating this kind of homogenized narrative. But I'm not entirely convinced that it will fly. Everything has an expiry date. Everything has a shelf life. And I think in the 20th century, there will be ups and downs, but I don't think Hindu nationalism is the summation or the totality of this narrative or this story. It is a byproduct that has emerged at a specific juncture, and we're going to have to deal with that byproduct, but it is not Hinduism. And Hinduism is a much broader entity. And to even make the accident of sort of conflating the two, of assuming that Hindu nationalism now defines Hinduism, is to tacitly give way and give into that. Whereas we should actually deny that. You know? Why is Hindu nationalism Hinduism? It is not, in my opinion. Again, historians don't take sides on these things. You know, historical dynamics happen. There's no one way to predict how this will all end up. But again, personally, I don't think it's easy to wipe out that kind of heterogeneity. As I said, Manch Murugan happened sometime in the last 15 years. So if that can happen even now, then it's, you know, who knows?
Okay, now I need chocolate. You know, you mentioned in the book, you said Hinduism was never shaped by a book as much as by the currents of history. And I think that affirms the point you were making. The book is God's Guns and Missionaries, the Making of the Modern Hindu Identity. Manu Pillai, thank you so much for the book.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being such a patient audience. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.